Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today in our program, Repeal and Replace is back on the operating table. We'll look at the CBO numbers.
They have been wildly wrong in their Obamacare projections for years, embarrassingly off by millions of people.
And President Trump draws the ire of elites again, this time with the Paris Climate Accord.
This is a bad deal, not just for the United States, but it's a bad deal for the world.
Later, a look at the Trump tax cuts.
We can't reduce spending in the federal government as Republicans when we have a president in the White House and control of the Senate and the House. We are basically lying to the voters that have elected us.
Senator Tom Cotton explains why he believes they are necessary.
We should focus on the kind of tax cuts that are going to get more money in the hands of working people who deserve it.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. As you've likely heard, as it was shouted from the mainstream media mountaintops, the Congressional Budget Office believes the latest version of Repeal and Replace will cost 23 million people their insurance. And according to Bernie Sanders, thousands will die. Obamacare has actually only enrolled 11.5 million people, so you can imagine that there are some issues with the CBO number. And of the 11.5, most were forced to enroll. Townhall.com political editor Guy Benson has been covering the repeal and replace effort. He joined Salem host Mike Gallagher.
I want to talk about health care with what you wrote regarding health care and the whole debate about the health care bill. You fact-checked the claim that we keep hearing over and over again about how 23 million people will lose their insurance under the American Health Care Act. You write that's just not true.
Yeah, it's false. Totally false. Because if you English language words have to mean things. And when you look at the verb to lose, that suggests, it means, that you have something and then it's gone.
Right.
When you look at the 23 million number that people are citing through this Congressional Budget Office study, it is a tiny fraction of that 23 million that are people who currently have coverage that they would want to keep and it would be taken away from them under this bill. Of course, they would get tax credits to buy new coverage, and for a number of them, it would be less expensive. But there would be some people in that bucket. But everyone else, and I wrote this whole piece at townhall.com earlier in the week explaining a lot of these folks are people who are only buying Obamacare because they have to under law. If the mandate right. goes away, they might make the decision, I'm not going to keep overpaying for something that isn't very good. That right. is, to me, qualitatively different than losing something. That's making a choice for yourself. And then more importantly, I think beyond that, a lot of that 23 million, millions and millions within that group by CBO, these are people who currently have no coverage. These are people that the CBO projects one day will sign up for health care under Obamacare's mandate or would live in a state that at some point will expand Medicaid that has not done so already. I think that their underlying reasons for those projections are highly suspect. The Congressional Budget Office has always put way more faith in the efficacy of the individual mandate in Obamacare right. than has been borne out in reality. And they have just been, they try hard, CBO is important, but they have been wildly wrong in their Obamacare projections for years, embarrassingly off by millions of people. And yet they are continuing to use these false projections as baselines as opposed to looking at the actual data that proves right. their previous projections wrong.
Go to townhallreview.com to catch the full conversation of Gallagher and Benson. Meanwhile, an election took place a little over a week ago. It was an unusually timed Thursday special election in the state of Montana. Greg Gianforte made things interesting with his takedown of a reporter the day before the election. My friend and colleague Michael Medved looks at the outcome of that high-profile congressional race.
There are all kinds of reactions to the victory, and it was a decisive victory, not a landslide, but a decisive victory for the Republican nominee, Gianforte. And Greg Gianforte is going to be the new congressman from Montana, and with his substantial victory, he claimed it in a distinguished and, I think, a fairly effective manner.
Thank you, Montana! Tonight is all about you. Tonight is your victory. Over the last 2 years, you've made tens of thousands of phone calls. You've knocked on hundreds of thousands of doors. Thank you.
Okay, and that's gracious and it's appropriate, and there were tons of volunteers. There was also tons of money that pumped into this campaign, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. Gianforte won with 50.2% of the vote. He won by 6 percentage points. And Democrats are saying, well, this is a moral victory for us because it's Montana. But we ought to be aware that Governor Brian Schweitzer in Montana, Democrats win a bunch of stuff in Montana. John Tester, who is the senator from Montana, Democrat, is going to be up for re-election this coming time. He's one of those endangered Democratic senators that I know Republicans are eager to pick off. So the idea that somehow losing by 6 points in Democratic world is somehow a Democratic triumph, I think it's a nonsensical idea. And they claim the same sort of thing with a prior special election in Kansas for Mike Pompeo's seat, where they lost by 7 points. Look, the idea of trying to play games with numbers, a win is a win is a win. And Gianforte won, and he won despite the fact that he had been cited for misdemeanor assault the day before the election because of assaulting a reporter in an unforgivable way. But far more unforgivable than the way that he assaulted the reporter was the way he initially dealt with it. His campaign issued a statement that was clearly not true. It was totally dishonest. And by the way, despite the pretense of some voices on the right, it was totally contradicted by the testimony of eyewitnesses, all of whom worked for Fox News. So please stop it. And in an appropriate way, the new congressman from Montana, who's a good guy, whose name is Greg Gianforte, he did begin the process of making this right. Here he is.
When you make a mistake, you have to own up to it. That's the Montana way. I'm not proud of what happened. I should not have responded in the way that I did. And for that, I'm sorry. I should not have treated that reporter that way. And for that, I'm sorry, Mr. Ben Jacobs.
Okay, and probably the I'm sorry should also involve, I don't know if he has actually called Ben Jacobs and spoken to him, but he should. Okay, got all of that. Not perfect, not great, but really, is it something that is worth comparing to the Holocaust? Now, this is a rhetorical question. It's obviously not worth comparing to the Holocaust. Nobody died. Nobody suffered serious injury. It was wrong. It was rude. It was out of control. But for goodness sake, it would take a professor from Princeton, right? The Princeton professor, Eddie Gloud, who is the William S. Todd professor of religion. He's taught at Princeton for 15 years, and I think it's gone to his head. Because he spoke about Gianforte's victory in terms where he had to bring up Hannah Arendt's book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, and to talk about the banality of evil. Here was Professor Gloud on MSNBC.
The initial press release was to deny all of the specifics. Mm-hmm. And so then you come back and apologize. So you don't apologize for lying initially, you apologize for the act. This reminds me of Hannah Arendt, Eichmann in Jerusalem, the banality of evil. And the banality of evil is not just simply that ordinary people do bad things, it's that stupidity is unexceptional. Stupidity is unexceptional. So there's a sense in which everyday ordinary people are buying into this sort of behavior as a reflection of their own values, as a reflection of their own commitments.
Have you got all that? I mean, why it is that hitting a reporter and knocking him down and behaving badly is comparable to Eichmann in Jerusalem. And there's this phrase, I don't think he's ever read the book, frankly. I don't know. I mean, the whole idea that stupidity is unexceptional, that's not a Hannah Arendt idea. I'm sorry. This is just, the whole thing is just pathetic.
This week, President Donald Trump had a unique opportunity to undo a major mess known as the Paris Climate Agreement. Mike Gallagher discussed the trouble with this agreement with Heritage Foundation's Brett Schaefer.
What does the United States face as a consequence of Obama signing the Paris Agreement?
Well, what the United States did is it committed to reduce its carbon dioxide emissions by 26% to 28% below levels in 2005 by the year 2025.
Right. What's that do to energy costs?
Well, it's going to increase energy costs significantly. It's going to put every household in the United States is going to lose income over the next decades in order to comply with this.
Yep.
It's going to cost the U.S. economy jobs because we, in order to do this, you're going to have to clamp down regulatorily on various industries to try and meet these different targets. And all of this, of course, is directly opposed to President Trump's energy agenda. And so when the president announced earlier this year he's going to roll back President Obama's climate policies and energy agenda regulations, then he put him at direct opposition to these commitments under the Paris Protocol. Mm-hmm. So this was a confrontation on policy that was going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah, but he made a promise, as you alluded to a moment ago, all through his campaign. He said, we're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. We're going to stop all payments of U.S. tax dollars to U.N. global warming programs. Now, the left is in sheer hysteria over this because to many of them, they think the world's about to end tomorrow. So they're very angry about it. They're going to go nuts if he pulls out of the Paris Agreement, aren't they?
Well, they are already going nuts. You're seeing the reactions in various outlets. The European countries, of course, are very upset about this. And the left, in terms of climate activist organizations, environmental organizations, are very upset about this because their agenda is, of course, to see Paris complied with and followed through on by the United States, regardless of the cost that it's going to have for the United States, for American families, and for our industry and our economic growth going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's important to note that if everything that is promised under Paris, not just the United States but other countries, comply fully with the Paris Agreement, which is going to cost the global economy trillions of dollars over the next century, what you're going to get in exchange for that is a 0.2 degrees Celsius reduction in warming by the year 2100.
Wow, really?
So even after all this economic sacrifice, all this burden that you're putting on the American families and on the American economy, you're not even going to make a discernible impact on the projected warming that they've outlined.
Right, right.
And so this is a bad deal, not just for the United States, but it's a bad deal for the world. And we need to recognize that if this is truly a serious problem, this is not the solution to it.
Coming up,
if we can't reduce spending in the federal government as Republicans, when we have a president in the White House and control of the Senate and the House, we are basically lying to the voters that have elected us.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Colorado Congressman Ken Buck has a new book out titled Drain the Swamp, which tackles the corruption in Washington. A title like that could run 50,000 pages, but thankfully for me, this one doesn't. I spoke with Congressman Buck on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Ken Buck, in Drain the Swamp, you talk about all the things that need to be done, and we agree a lot on the regulatory dismantling of the regulatory, the administrative state, et cetera. But to do that, you got to like chair energy and commerce. You have to be able to move, as Kevin McCarthy has, the Congressional Review Act. Are you going to play the game to gather the influence, or are you going to stand on the outside? I'm curious about the choice you have to make.
Yeah. Are you asking me personally? And so I have done my very best to be part of the team, but at the same time make sure that we are changing the incentive structure in Washington, D.C. so we can get to the right answer. If we can't reduce spending in the federal government as Republicans, when we have a president in the White House and control of the Senate and the House, we are basically lying to the voters that have elected us. We have made promises that we're going to move forward on a fiscally conservative agenda, and we've got to do that. So my job is to be true to the voters who have elected me and the people of the United States and what I think is the highest priority.
Now, Congressman, I'm at work on a piece for the Washington Post. Today, the Wall Street Journal has a story. GOP's proposed tax changes are no match for the status quo. You and I both know our corporate tax rate has to come. It just has to come down to 15% or we are not competitive. We also know that we need simplification, fewer rates and things like that. But we have to find some revenue. It's not all going to come back from growth. And to me, sales taxes are always fair because they're above board. They hit everybody, including those who don't pay income tax. and you can actually adjust your consumption to avoid the tax if you are so inclined. Would you make that trade, a corporate tax cut in exchange for a sales tax hike?
I don't think the federal government should be involved in the business of creating a new tax, if that's what you're asking, a federal sales tax. I do think that there are a lot of programs in the federal government that we can cut, and we have to cut, and we have to put on our big boy and big girl pants and be able to take the political fallout from cutting programs. But we are spending money at a devastating rate right now. And so I think that we should look at cutting federal programs, number one, and number two, by reducing the loopholes, the deductions, we can also get pretty far down the road, I believe, to paying for the reduction in both the individual income tax rate and the corporate tax rate.
Well, you and I might have to mix it up a little bit, because I stand on the side of the home mortgage interest deduction and the state and local income tax deduction, the charity deduction. I'll fight people over that one. But I do believe cutting spending makes sense, but the president won't reform entitlements, Ken Buck. He said no.
And that's absolutely right. And we have to reform Social Security and Medicare, and we have to do that soon, or we won't be able to afford those down the road. And so I think everybody, you know, the interesting part of that article is that everybody has their favorite deduction, their favorite cutout in the tax code. And if we're going to get this economy back moving again, we've got to reduce the tax rates, and we've got to make sure that we gore everybody's ox, and we do it in a fair and transparent way.
Well, I hope that's the case. Now, I want to get to the one thing you argue for that we're really going to disagree. My buddy Levin and I am not in favor of an Article 5 convention. Drain the Swamp, your brand new book is. Why do you? I think it would become runaway. I think the left would own it. What do you think, Congressman Buck?
Well, if the left owns it, the fallback is that 38 states have to pass whatever amendments are passed by the convention of the states. I think it is the only way that we're going to get to a balanced budget amendment. Congress will never restrict its ability to spend, and Congress will never term limit itself. And those are two things that I think are absolutely necessary in order to change the incentive structure in Washington, D.C., and reduce the spending and avoid the cliff that we are rapidly approaching.
For the complete conversation with Ken Buck, go to townhallreview.com. It seems like everything President Trump does is overanalyzed and criticized, and the man himself is perpetually demonized. But in the end, there is one thing that drives elections: the economy. A president can withstand a lot of darts if the economy is growing and people can afford their home. Mike Gallagher spoke with Senator Tom Cotton.
The election, I truly believe, was in large measure about the economy, middle class jobs, wages, tax relief. Tax reform has to get done. Where are we today with that process, Senator?
I think we're moving along at a good pace. You know, we're only 4 months into this presidency. The founders had a 4-year term, not a 4-month term for presidents, for a good reason. A lot of the conversation is happening as it should, in private, so we can have candid exchange of ideas and we can identify what's going to work and what's not going to work, both from a policy standpoint and from getting the votes that we need to pass this legislation. But right now I feel pretty good about where we're moving on both health care and tax reform, and on a lot of other issues I'm working on as well, whether it's immigration or the defense budget, what have you. That's where most of my colleagues are as well. You know, even if they're not out on radio or TV programs, they're focused on the agenda on which we all campaign and on which we want to deliver for the American people.
One of the big battles, and you talk about policy and tax reform, and one of the big fights is the border adjustment tax. We've been talking about it for a number of weeks here on my show. There's obviously a pushback from the automotive industry. There's a lot of people concerned about a tax like this. You've been quoted as saying a tax on imports is a tax on things working folks buy every single day. I'm not talking caviar and champagne. I'm talking T-shirts, jeans, shoes, baby clothes, toys, and groceries. Can you walk us through this border adjustment tax, Senator Cotton, and tell us why you're against it?
Yeah, Mike, the border tax really is an import tax. It would allow companies to exclude from income tax anything they sell overseas. But it would also prevent them from deducting anything they buy overseas and sell here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand the impulse behind it, some of the unfair trade flows that the president identified. But what the House of Representatives proposed, I just don't think is good, especially for working families in Arkansas. I mean, that the House plan would increase tax rates on the lowest tax rate, and it would cause them to pay more for their stuff at Walmart or Dillard's or any other mom-and-pop retailer. That's simply not what we all campaigned on. And it has some troublesome resemblance to a VAT tax, a value-added tax, which anybody who's ever traveled overseas knows is kind of national sales tax that's built into every stage of a product's manufacture and packaging and marketing. And politicians in Europe love the VAT tax because you don't see it. It's embedded in the price of a good, unlike, say, an increase in sales tax here in the U.S. or an increase in your income tax. We didn't campaign on introducing an entire new system of taxation into our federal tax system. We especially didn't campaign on making working people pay more for their stuff at Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that we should go back to the drawing board. This idea does not have support in the Senate. It doesn't have support in the White House either. And we should focus on the kind of tax cuts that are going to get more money in the hands of working people who deserve it and who, you know, if they had that more money, I think it would be good for our economy as well.
Coming up.
If you're going to give a 9 or a 10-year-old a cell phone, why don't you give them a bottle of vodka and tell them to carry it around for 3 or 4 years and don't open it? What do you think they're going to do?
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. Get the podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Every parent of young children worries about losing a child to a predator. They are out there, and the Internet is providing predators with access to children that no generation of parents had to deal with ever before. Larry Elder spoke with Opal Singleton, author of the book Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers.
Opal, you say this on page 87 in your book. For many parents, handing a 10-year-old a smartphone is like handing a child a grenade and saying, I have to run to the store. I'll be right back. Don't pull that pin, okay? Explain that.
Well, think about what we're doing here, Larry. We are handing kids cell phones before they go through puberty, before they even have a frontal lobe. And they may be the best kids in the whole world, but they don't have cognitive reasoning. And what do we think is going to go wrong here? I always say if you're going to give a 9 or a 10-year-old a cell phone, why don't you give them a bottle of vodka and tell them to carry it around for 3 or 4 years and don't open it? What do you think they're going to do?
My guest is Opal Singleton. The book is Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers. We're talking about sex trafficking. Opal, when I think about sex trafficking, I envision the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, and he's got a daughter who he reluctantly allows to go to France, and she is essentially abducted by somebody who targeted her at the airport. Is that the way it goes down?
Not most of the time.
I wouldn't have thought so. I thought it was a movie, yeah.
Yeah, it really can come down as kidnapping, but most of the time what you see is you get a young person and they meet up with somebody on the Internet. That's what literally instant messaging is all about. They get an app like Kik or Messenger or WhatsApp, and he'll say something cute and funny, and she says something cute and funny back, and they go back and forth. They do an Instagram, a Facebook, you know, they'll maybe meet up on a video game, they'll share YouTube, and all the time mom and dad are saying, don't talk to strangers on there, but he's not a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, she will go out and get in the car with him, and that is when her life changes.
What do we do about this?
Well, I believe it starts at home. One of the reasons I wanted to share this with you is there's a lot of political hubbub going on this subject at this point. And some of that can be good. You know, some of it is all right, Larry, but so much of it goes wrong, and I don't believe that we can legislate social behavior. This is the first generation in all of history that we have handed a device to where they can reach the entire world, and the entire world can reach them. And technology is not good or bad. You know, it depends on how we choose to bring up our young people. I believe, actually, it's an interesting thing. This is the first time since the Tower of Babel that God's allowed us all to come together. And I believe it's important that we'll be held responsible for how we bring up this next generation. It is the greatest opportunity of all time, but it's also the greatest responsibility.
My guest is Opal Singleton, president and CEO of Million Kids. The book is called Seduced, The Grooming of America's Teenagers. In your book, you talk about a 2012 Pew Research poll that talks about the kinds of things that young people post. 71% of teens post their school name. 72% post the city or town where they live. 92% post their real name. 84% post their interests like movies, music, books. 82% post their birth date. 62% post their relationship status. 91% post a photo of themselves. 24% post videos of themselves. I would not have thought that on the surface doing those kinds of things, depending upon what the content of the video is, would be problematic.
Oh, it's a problem if you have a predator out there waiting to meet up with you. You see, it isn't just the interaction on technology. What parents need to understand is this concept of grooming and being groomed. Because what will happen is on the internet, think about this, you overcome your inhibitions, you deny your normal instincts. You know, you feel anonymous. You will try things that normally you would never try. I mean, I can't imagine a 14-year-old girl who goes to the mall, meets a new guy, and an hour they go in the bathroom and take a naked photo, and they share it. That doesn't happen because you have inhibitions. But on the internet, kids will try anything with total strangers. When that stranger is a pedophile, of which there are well over a million pedophiles, we are starting to believe that there's somewhere around 3 to 5 million, and the entire world is coming together, by the way, in 3 years the entire world will be connected by internet. That means that your child can reach anybody, and anybody can reach your child. And that is a problem because they bond. They start to get involved and start to talk to your child about morality, spirituality, sexuality, things that were the holy grail for a parent. And, you know, people think this is all about girls, but guys are not exempt.
Coming up.
That's the goal. It's not to win a war. It's to be prepared for a war so that it doesn't occur.
Donald Rumsfeld on our military when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense on 9/11. Already a key post in every post-war administration, suddenly SecDef became the center of a war on terror that spanned the globe. He was the right man at the right time. Of course, the war on terror continues. Even this week, a massive truck bomb in Kabul killed over 90 people, injured 400 more. I spoke with Donald Rumsfeld on the Hugh Hewitt Show just after President Trump's visit to NATO. And now we turn to the news that you were also among your many jobs, not only the author of Known and Unknown, your wonderful memoir and Rumsfeld Rules, but you were the ambassador to NATO. President Trump was at NATO yesterday, and here is what he said to our allies.
If all NATO members had spent just 2% of their GDP on defense last year, we would have had another $119 billion for our collective defense and for the financing of additional NATO reserves. We should recognize that with these chronic underpayments and growing threats, even 2% of GDP is insufficient to close the gaps in modernizing readiness and the size of forces. We have to make up for the many years lost. 2% is the bare minimum for confronting today's very real and very vicious threats.
So, Secretary Rumsfeld, what do you make of the substance of his critique and the fact that he delivered it with the heads of government standing next to him among our NATO allies?
He's exactly on the mark. When I was ambassador, we were working with our allies to try to get them to make larger investments in their national security. And today, our allies are largely below 2% of GDP invested in defense. The United States has now dropped from 10% under Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson
10% of gross domestic product going to defense. We're down below 4%. So President Trump is exactly right. He's talking to the right people, and there's no question but that the deterrent effect, if the NATO allies do what President Trump is suggesting, the deterrent would be vastly greater than it is today, and that's the goal. It's not to win a war. It's to be prepared for a war so that it doesn't occur.
How about that he did it with them standing right there, in which some people have said is undiplomatic and unnecessarily embarrassing to them?
That's utter nonsense. If you're not going to stand up and look people in the eye and tell them the truth, these people are not youngsters. They know. They're heads of government. They run those countries. And they need to hear it directly from each other and certainly from the United States.
Let me move to some other major issues, Secretary Rumsfeld. Secretary Mattis and Chairman Joe Dunford are basically running the Pentagon on their own. Where are the appointees? There aren't any service secretaries confirmed yet.
No, and you know, that's not unusual. When I went in there as secretary the second time in 2001, it was months, literally months, before we had a deputy and the assistant secretaries and the undersecretaries and the service secretaries. As a matter of fact, I picked up the phone the other day and thanked my predecessor's deputy for sticking around and giving me a hand. And he reminded me that his military assistant back in 2001 was a brigadier general in the Marines named Mattis. And now he's Secretary of Defense, which is wonderful. He's a,
I assume you agree that the Russians attacked our election via false news and cyber hacking and all that. Do you, Secretary Rumsfeld?
Sure. I mean, the Russians and other countries have an interest in what goes on in the United States, and to the extent they have the kinds of capabilities the Russians do, they have the ability and capability of engaging in things that are disruptive and harmful to other countries, including the United States.
I'm just curious. I have not yet seen. I agree, too. They attacked our election just as the Chinese attacked the OPM under the last president, under the last watch. But I have not seen any evidence yet of the so-called collusion. Have you?
No. These people who are, I suppose, they're running around trying to compare what's going on today to Watergate, which I think is ridiculous. I was in government during those years, thus far, I haven't seen any there, so to speak. The press is, maybe a lot of folks want to run around and be the new Woodwards and Bernsteins, and they're trying to create the kind of event that will put them on the map. But thus far, at least, I haven't seen anything that would even begin to compare.
All right, Mr. Secretary, I want to close by talking about a very old memo you wrote and a very current story. On October 16, 2003, you wrote a memo to then Chairman of the Joint Chief Dick Myers, Paul Wolfowitz, your number two, General Peter Pace, the deputy chair, Doug Feith, your undersecretary, asking, are we winning or losing the global war on terror? You wrote, today we lack metrics to know if we are winning or losing the global war on terror. Are we capturing, killing, or deterring and dissuading more terrorists every day than the Madrasa and the radical clerics are recruiting, training, and deploying against us? I want to link that with Jeremy Corbyn, who, if a disaster unfolds, could be the next prime minister of Great Britain, is making an argument that many experts, this is a direct quote, many experts, including professionals in our intelligence and security services, have pointed to the connections between wars our government has supported or fought in other countries and terrorism at home. That assessment in no way reduces the guilt of those who attack our children, but an informed understanding of the causes of terrorism is an essential part of the response that will protect the security of our people, that fights rather than fuels terrorism. We must be brave enough to admit that the war on terror is simply not working. We need a smarter way to reduce the threat from countries that nurture terrorists and generate terrorism. He both agrees with your basic premise from 15, 14 years ago that we're not winning, but he suggests it's in part our fault because we're fighting.
Well, I'd have to read the full statement to know what I thought about it, but I think right now we've just seen President Trump go into the Middle East, speak directly to some heads of state of 50 countries from that part of the world, and enlisted them and explained to them and tried to persuade them that their role in dealing with this struggle against terrorism is critically important. it's not the kind of a problem that's going to be won only with bullets. It's going to take people trying to persuade people that, the thing they ought to do as they go through their lives is not get trained to go out and kill innocent men, women, and children, but get trained to get a job and contribute to society. And he talked to exactly the right people about it. It seems to me that we don't really face up to the fact that this conflict is not going to be won with bullets alone. It's going to take that kind of leadership.
Coming up.
81% say the state of moral values is only fair or poor. 77% say the state of moral values is getting worse.
Michael Medved in the final segment of the Town Hall Review after this. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It seems every check, every look into the current moral values is negative. Polls and surveys seem to bring a constant barrage of bad news. But Michael Medved, a very positive soul, always seems to find a silver lining.
Why do people believe that our moral values are so bad and so much getting worse? 81% say the state of moral values is only fair or poor. 77% say the state of moral values is getting worse. And that means, by the way, that only recently the number of people who say things are getting worse has shot up. Yeah. In 1991, 63% of U.S. adults said they were dissatisfied with the ethics and moral standards of the American people. And back in 1996, 39% said the state of moral values in the country today was somewhat weak. Today, it's terrifying. What has gotten so terrible? Why do you believe that the sense of moral decline has heightened in our country? The idea of moral decline is so deep, it has particularly grown with the left. And that's the case for Bernie Sanders when he goes forward and he suggests that the Trump budget proposal that is now on the table is actually immoral.
At a time when the very rich are already getting much richer, while the middle class continues to shrink, this is a budget for the billionaire class, for Wall Street, for corporate CEOs, and for the wealthiest people in this country. This is a budget that is immoral and that will cause an enormous amount of pain for the most vulnerable people in our nation.
That's Bernie Sanders. The question that Gallup asked was this: how would you rate the overall state of moral values in this country today? Excellent? I don't think there's ever been a time when anyone would say, oh, morals in America are excellent, because we're a big country. And there are all sorts of different kinds of people. Good, only fair, or poor. Now, I'll tell you what I would say. What I would say would probably be good. Okay, I would. The reason I say good, normally I would say fair, but the option they give you is only fair, which means that they mean that it's below average. I think compared to other countries in the world, America's fine. With lots of room for improvement, of course.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. While you're at it, please rate our show. It helps others discover us. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richard, Derek Fowler, Adam Ramsey, Dwayne Patterson, and the new guy, David Posian. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.